Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
You are CIA. I'm sure you're CIA. It's CIA. They teach you how to do that, don't they? I'm not CIA.
Hi all, you are very welcome to episode 63 of Behind the Lines, here on The 42, with me, Gavin Cooney. This week's guest is writer and editor Bill Buford. Bill, in 1979, was a postgraduate student at Cambridge University, and it was there and then that he revived the famous literary magazine Granta. He went on to edit Granta for 17 years before crossing the Atlantic to be appointed fiction editor at The New Yorker magazine. He remains at The New Yorker as a staff writer to this day. Bill has also written a few books. The two most recent, Heat and Dirt, chronicle his efforts to become a chef in Italy and in France. But an earlier book of his is probably most relevant to the conversation that we're going to have in this show, his 1992 book, Among the Thugs, in which he wrote of his experiences embedded among English football hooligans who wrought violence on a twice weekly basis at home and across Europe in the mid and late 1980s. So let's get on with this conversation with Bill Buford. Bill, come here. Thanks so much for doing the show.
My pleasure.
Where are you weathering this pandemic?
We have just moved to Brooklyn, leaving Manhattan. We're in New York. We have twin boys, 15 years old, who have been schooling by Zoom since March, and our small apartment suddenly became very, 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 very small. We packed up for and moved to a place with more space.
So in my extensive research for this show, I came across a piece in The Observer from 2007 about Granta, and I found a description of you that runs such. It describes you, it's unattributed, but it describes you as crazy, inspiring, absolutely absurd lunatic. Do you endorse such words?
That's very flattering. I can imagine a few people who might have said such a thing. That was running Granta, which is a literary magazine that started when I finished my education at Cambridge, and continues to this day. And it was a magazine created really out of not much, basically the goodwill and best of intentions of a lot of people working with me and a lot of writers. And since it wasn't created with much, it was stressful and mad and a little lunatic. It's true.
Yeah. What are there any further grounds for people to call you a lunatic?
I don't know. I tend towards extremism. It's possible. Yeah. I tend towards just going a little bit further than most people. I'd like to think that that's been a kind of a principle for much of my writing that I've done. And that's inspired really by kind of an old-fashioned idea of writing, especially of travel writing, that if you're going to write about something that you want to write about something people don't know or haven't seen. And I regard myself as going on a journey that most people don't go on, and I want to come back with a story they haven't heard before. And that, you know when you get that. And I do push myself to get to that point. And when I was editing the magazine, I kind of pushed the magazine to get to those points where there'd just be something when you open it up, you go, oh, I think I want to read that.
Mm. Talk to us about reviving that magazine at Cambridge. Why'd you do it and how? That's pretty broad, I know.
It was a famous literary magazine. It was edited at one point by Ted Hughes and Sylvia Plath. It had been running since a date in the 19th century. I'm now forgetting when it was, but it had been publishing for a long time, and then ceased publishing when it ran out of funds, when a group of towering intellectuals produced an issue devoted to the signs of our times and French structuralism, and the treasurer was said to pocket all the remaining money and fled to Paris with his girlfriend. I was part of a loose confederation of people trying to revive the magazine, And I was doing it with my friend Pete DiBala, who's now professor of English at Cambridge. And we were at the pub at the Eagle, drinking pints outside. And we came up with an idea for an issue. Mine, because I was an American in England and as just discovering American writing now that I was no longer in America, but in England, suggested an issue on new American writing, and we got lots of writers, and it showed that we could produce a literary magazine that people wanted to read.
Whose career did you launch? Who owes you?
Oh, eventually the magazine became quite it became quite successful in its way. I mean, we were selling around 125,000 copies an issue. Our print runs were up to 150,000. And it was actually rather wonderful. There were lots of writers who first appeared in those pages, lots of writers who kind of got launched in those pages. It was exhilarating. And I remember when I left finally, to join the New Yorker. And at that point, Granta was I had sold Granta out of necessity. I was still running it, but I realized I was starting to get a little bored with it. And I took a job as the fiction editor of the New Yorker, which was a very exciting position. On my way to New York, I did a talk to the editors of National Geographic. It was like a big auditorium, and I talked about, I don't know, the importance of an original story or something like that. And afterwards, a whole bunch of photographers gathered around me, because one of the things I did at Granta was we published a lot of pretty gritty photojournalism, and it seemed to be the visual equivalent of what we're trying to do in the writing. And they all gathered around me and said, "What are you doing? Why are you leaving the magazine? Why do you want to work for a corporation? Do you have any idea what it's like to work for a corporation?" And suddenly I had this sinking feeling. I thought, "Oh, damn! What have I done?" But it was a good ride. I was in England about 20 years. I did the magazine for maybe 15 years. It was a great, exciting ride.
Talk to us about some of the names that became like ultra successful, having first graced the pages of Granta.
Oh, I don't know. That's in a way that kind of database has been erased. But it was, Salman Rushdie appeared first in the magazine. Graham Swift certainly wasn't the first time he was published, but we published the beginning of what became Waterland. A lot of travel writers. Hanif Qureshi, another writer. We did Best of Young British Writers in 1983, the 20 Best British Writers, and then we did it again in 1993. And then after that, I left, they did it again in 2003. It was actually a place where energetic literary fiction could coexist with energetic first-person journalism. And in many ways, it ties into what I ended up doing on my own with Among the Thugs, which began with my American perspective on life in Britain and being perplexed why it was considered normal that young men should gather on Saturdays and beat each other up all over the country, and that this was just, it was just lads will be lads. And it was, whereas I thought, this is really unusual. This is not normal. And I tried to get, the magazine didn't have much money then. And this would have been like 1983. And I tried to get people to do the story, and I couldn't get anyone to do it. And in the end, I came upon a football train in a little rural station in Wales that had been taken over by supporters, and the train was stopping for police reinforcements. And I thought, oh, this really is a story somebody's got to do. And I ended up doing it. It was possible in part because, of course, matches were then played almost exclusively on Saturdays. So, I could do it while keeping my day job.
So you set out to figure out why, this violence took place and are twice weekly basis across England and then across Europe. Why did it? What were your, were there any conclusions or findings?
Well, I went in it pretty, with a pretty open mind. There were a lot of generalizations. Yeah, it was like working class angst. It was the, it was Thatcherism expressing itself. Then there were either the resistance to Thatcher. It was deprived individuals. And it none of that seemed true, but I went into it with an open mind. I was thinking about it. I mean, I did discover what was at work in it. But in the course of it, I discovered a number of other things, including a lot about the behavior of crowds and how crowds change as members of the crowd feel their strength and their invincibility and their power. And also, I came to love football. I was thinking about it in anticipation of talking with you today, that the chapter in that book that I enjoy the most is the one called Waiting for a Goal. And I recently did an audio version of the book, and quite a bit of it stood up, but the some didn't. But the part that I enjoyed reading the most was this passage about, it was a whole chapter on waiting for a goal. And that arose out of a trip I took to Leeds, and I hadn't been to Leeds, and there wasn't really anything. It was I can't even remember the match. It was meant to be a potentially confrontational match, but it was also a chance for me to get to Leeds, see the Leeds fans. I stood in the terraces behind the goal, and I was at that moment, and it was a men's crowd. It was more than a boys' crowd. It was a men's crowd. It certainly wasn't a family crowd. But whenever the ball would get into the penalty area, you could feel everybody tense up. And like it was like, we're all very tight, so it like the space suddenly disappeared. And then the ball would get into the penalty area, in the penalty box again, they'd all tense up again, then it goes again. And there was no one even had a shot on goal, but each time it was like so tense and so much anticipation, just waiting for this thing, which clearly is just statistically, geographically impossible to pull off. And I realized, oh wow, it's so different from American sports, where there's a lot of gratification, there's a lot of scoring. You're like, I mean, baseball's the slowest of them all, but I mean, basketball, you're like, go score, 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 score. Or American football, which is all about these sort of magnificent scoring opportunities at the end of a game. It's like, this is all about deprivation and craving and need, and you know, I would do anything for the ball to cross that line and hit the back of the net. And that was a wonderful discovery. And it sort of revealed the excitement and the wonder of the game. So, I mean, there was a lot of other things I got out of it other than just hanging around with, like, despicable, ugly people behaving badly.
And boy, did they behave badly. Like, you go on various trips, particularly one with Man United fans to Turin, and this is effectively, you know, the Northern English version of running with the bulls. Like, when you look back on the book now, what's the first story that comes to mind? Or when you look at your scars, maybe?
That was a very big deal. I've been hanging around with some Man United fans. I've been going to games. I've been starting to meet people in the firm. But I hadn't gotten through, and everybody denied that there was violence, or they were violence, and they were, you know, they were not people who participated in it. And, you know, they're just like lads out for a drink and a laugh. And went to Turin, and we were welcomed by the British consulate, who was very nervous, and lots of Italian police. And we were given a police escort into the center of town with sirens blaring to take the lads to their accommodation, if they had accommodation. And from that moment on, everything changed. I don't know. I'd never been in a police escort with sirens blaring as you're going through this legendary metropolis. And everybody in the city knew that we'd arrived, and I'm already using the first person plural. I'd already was losing my identity as a detached journalist, but it immediately there was us and them, and it just accelerated. Everything accelerated from that moment, culminating finally in a night of just kind of nightmarish, weird crowd violence on a black night with not very good lighting and just some terrible violence as they went through the city of Turin. I mean, they'd also got, they were provoking, and they provoked, and then the provokers provoked them, and I think in some ways it all goes back to the moment of arriving in the city with a police escort, until finally on the square where I happened to have got my room along with other people who'd come through this particular travel agency, there was a tank. There was a tank on the square to deal with the England supporters. And the it was no longer the police, it was the military, it was the army. It was a wild night. I mean, it was just wild, wild night. I was up for hours just writing up my notes, what I had seen and what I thought and what I heard. And I thought, this is wild.
What was the point of it all? Like the violence? And like, what's the point in landing somewhere and then a few hours later being faced with the Italian military?
Well, in some ways it's a... You know, it exaggerates what takes place in it was then taking place in domestic matches. And this is, you got to remember, it was a long time ago. There was terraces. It was standing room only. There was no closed circuit television. The police were very good at controlling crowds and monitoring crowds, and they knew what they were up against. But there was a real us and them mentality. And almost... It's like that generation's excitement. It was their buzz, was to hang out in crowds on Saturdays. And the you know, like the 19-year-olds and the 20-year-olds and the 21-year-olds did it. So then the lads from school would do it, and the young lads would do it, and the 14-year-olds would do it, and the 13-year-olds would do it. And it was like, you know, it was the equivalent. It was like a trend. It was the equivalent of a drug, and it was a very druggy experience to be in a big crowd fight with dogs and police and the possibility of extreme violence or a knife. And it's a real high octane adrenaline buzz of a high order. What happened in Italy was it somehow became much more than that, and it became England against Italy, and became the Queen, and became nationalism, and became the Union Jack, and all those symbols that are so appealing to your Irish listeners, I'm sure.
So we got a few questions in from our listeners for you, and one came from Gavin Riley asking, is there any coherent identity around which these football firms corralled, or was it just... the buzz of it all?
Oh, there's definitely an identity. It seemed pretty flimsy. Seemed a little arbitrary. Like going in and being in Italy and, you know, believing that you're defending the Queen and the Union Jack. I mean, what I did feel with them actually is that they were, especially when you went abroad, it was a generation of lads who really wanted to go to war, and they really wanted to defend England. And they couldn't accept the idea that England didn't want to have anything to do with them, and the Queen would be horrified to know that they believed they were defending her. That's sort of the whole thing writ large. It's kind of a big nationalism, but then it's also a small, kind of small scale nationalism when it's Chelsea or it's Manchester United or it's Manchester City or it's Arsenal, and they're like little small clans and countries. I did at one point come up with an idea that, you know, the male brain is clearly damaged, and there's something that occurs in this age where between boys and men especially that is society has figures out different ways of accommodating them. Either they put them in the military or they send them off to the church, or they, you know, they draft them, or they send them to university or something. But it's a weird, dangerous, difficult age when who knows for what reasons, whether it's biological or socially inculcated, when they have no fear and they kind of want to experience fear. This must go back. It's very primitive, but really impressively authoritative. They say boys will be boys, but man, it's much worse than that.
You did dip into using we earlier on. Did you gaze into the abyss and find the abyss gazing back? Did it turn? Did you feel turned and radicalized among these hooligans?
I never forgot why I was there, which was to write about it, the violence, and them. My brief to myself was to suspend judgment and get as close to the violence as I could and as close to the experience of being in a crowd as I could. Invariably, since my acceptance by the group was essential to my being present, otherwise they would, and they have turned on journalists and they would have turned on me. I made myself, it's the journalist thing is like, you're as a journalist, you're wanting to know. I mean, in some ways it's a natural consequence of being a journalist. You're writing about a subject. You devote all your interest to this subject. Your subject might be a murder. But you're engaged by your subject, genuinely engaged by your subject, because you want to know, well, why are you a murderer? And what did you do? And what's the story? And I can remember there was a guy, this was at Granta, Hugh Collins, who did kill people and went to jail and came out of jail and became an artist. And I've lost contact with him. And I'm sure he's now doing well and thriving. And but I remember sitting at a table with him and getting him to talk about a time when he stabbed someone and killed the man in a fight at a pub, which was actually a BBC filming of two rival gangs in Glasgow that went wrong. And I was completely engaged by his story and by him and his thoughts. And it's flattering to have a journalist's attention. And it's, you, as long as you're neutral and engaged, it's, and intelligent, you know, it changes. It's a very unusual social interaction. And I had that kind of relationship with these guys. I would talk to them for hours about why they did it, how they did it, what their life was like. And they had all kinds of really eccentric theories about how crowd violence should be conducted. And I'd be really interested. And I usually wouldn't take notes. I would take notes not in their presence, but they knew what I was doing. And then in the course of it, I did get kind of caught up a little bit in the violence. Not to the extent that I was ever violent, but I can remember there was one little nasty Chelsea redhead supporter, short and mean, who was going around, I'm sure I wrote about it, but he was going around and surprising Man United fans from behind and choking them on the Adam's apple, just coming, and then they go, and then they'd slip away. And I was following him and I thought, I'm so close to grabbing this guy and throttling him. But it was kind of a reflex. It was a response to his kind of terrorist violence perpetrated against the people I was hanging out with.
And after a while,
there is one awful scene when I come back from Turin and I'm at a underground station in London and I'm feeling filthy and I've got all this stuff in my head and I've got all this violence in my head and there's an aged couple trying to make their way down the staircase because the escalator's not working and I do verbally abuse them, own up to it and write about it. It doesn't make me happy, but it's sort of indication of what it is just to be in this experience.
A lot of the guys, particularly those going on the European trips, obviously can afford to do it. So they have decent jobs, you know, decent white collar Monday to Friday jobs. And I do sometimes wonder if the guy who wrote Fight Club read your book first, because all the good ideas in Fight Club are in this, to the point where I know one of the hooligans that you talk to manufactures soap. You know, I mean, it's been on the nose, but
right.
But like what I've talked
about, there's been some borrowings.
Yeah, yeah. Because that idea of incredibly nihilistic violence. Like I've got a quote picked out here from a guy who he's a United fan, says the violence, we've all got it in us. It just needs a cause. It needs an acceptable way of coming out. It's got to come out. Everyone's got it in them. How do you reflect on that quote now?
I don't think it's a universal thing. Just like I don't think it's a universal thing to enjoy being a member of a crowd. But I do think, I did come away thinking there really is a kind of unpredictably psychotic element in the male psyche. I don't think that violence is true of the people who actually bear children, though I think all of us have the potential for violence. All of us have the potential to be not civilized and even to crave not being civilized and wanting to be liberated by not being civilized. But that kind of violence, it does seem to be especially a domain of men between the age of 16 and 24 or something like that. I thought hard, especially about the crowd violence, because I thought like, you know, when you get in a crowd, it's very exciting. You have a lot of, nobody can really stop you. I mean, unless they're gonna shoot you down, which is of course one's fear about what's happening in Russia right now, because in the protest of Putin, there are big crowds, and I fear for what's going to happen to them, because you can, as it happened in Tiananmen Square, just shoot them all down. But short of that, a crowd is really powerful and unstoppable, and it is exhilarating to be in a crowd. And I've often thought about it here in New York. There's a great pleasure in New York, or there was until COVID, of being a member of a crowd. And if you're, you know, the March of Heroes or the Walk of Heroes, there's a whatever, like the Yankees win the World Series, there's like thousands packing to watch the Yankees come by in a bus, or there are big things in Central Park with thousands of people to come out to see, I don't know, some ridiculous Disneyland thing, but there's pleasure in a crowd if you find pleasure in a crowd, but it's not something that everybody is comfortable with. Not everybody wants to pack as they do here in the thousands to watch the lighting of a Christmas tree at the Rockefeller Center. But people do. Now, of course, New York can't have crowds, and it's a different kind of New York. But I don't think crowds are for everybody, but there is a real pleasure possible in being in a crowd. And the violence is something that can come out of it, which, of course, happened in Washington, D.C., on the Capitol building, when there was a crowd, and the kind of crowd that I kind of recognized. I could see how that crowd was behaving.
Really, yeah. So, I mean, my favorite part of the book is fantastic. I mean, all listeners listening should get it. Where has it been all my life was kind of what I was thinking reading it this week. And the stuff on the crowds, I think, is my favorite bit, because you make a very salient point, is that crowds are only described by its victims or by those looking on at the crowd, you know? So we're often told the why of a crowd, like why they're gathered, why are they violent, why are they cheering, blah, 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 whatever the crowd are doing. But as you explain, we never really understand the what of a crowd, like who's in it, why are they in it, you know? So what kind of things did you learn about a crowd to just tease that out a little bit more?
It's not normal. Not entirely, and that's my point. I don't think at one point I thought there's a need for a crowd, because it makes you feel bigger, it makes you kind of lose your identity, you lose your inhibitions. But I don't think it's true that everybody wants to be in a crowd. I think there are a lot of people, among them would be my wife, possibly my children, who would be really uncomfortable in a crowd. It's not a need, it's not a universal need, But if you're of the temperament that gets excited by it, it has the potential to, it gives you a sense of power that you would never have by yourself. And that power is the power of numbers. And it arises out of the fact that, you know, at its most elementary level, you know, there's pleasure in being a sporting match and being part of the crowd, or in that Leeds match that I was describing before, where you're waiting for a goal, then finally the goal comes and it's like the greatest thing in your life and you're enjoying this with this crowd. I mean, that's deeply pleasurable. And it is kind of bigger than you, and it's more enjoyable that it's being shared than it would be if you're at home watching on television, jumping up and down and getting complaints from your neighbors. But there is another element in a crowd which just makes you feel stronger and bigger and more powerful, almost omnipotent, than you would ever feel at any other moment in your life. And that is powerful. That's what political authorities fear. That's what the Russians fear. That's now what the politicians in Washington, D.C. fear, because when you're at that point in a crowd, all the normal restrictions and conventions drop away because you come to see that they are just agreements. And like agreements, you just agree to disagree. So in Washington, there were barriers, but, you know, it's a big crowd. They could lift up the barriers, they could push them aside. There were policemen, but there are not many policemen, and the crowd is much bigger. And unless the policeman's going to start shooting them with a machine gun, they just push the policeman aside. And some policemen did shoot a gun, and one woman was killed by a gun. That was a moment when this hollowed, just, you know, heart of America, the Capitol building, they just burst through the doors, even the doors. They normally would stop you. They were locked, but you're a crowd. You can push through those doors. That's the excitement of a crowd, and it's unpredictable.
Yeah, and what you describe in the book is how pain and violence comes from a crowd, and it's the way you describe it. And tell me if I'm picking this up wrong, but it's almost like a kind of principle of pleasure that in our daily lives we have a gazillion simultaneous thoughts going at once, and it's hard to kind of arrange them all and get in a kind of coherent view of things. But when you're in a crowd and you're faced with violence or the possibility of pain, that is like, it's almost like everything in all those disparate thoughts in your head just kind of meld together, and it's just one kind of singular experience. Am I articulating things accurately there?
Yes, the kind of present tenseness that can be described as ecstasy or religious ecstasy. It's complete immediacy. I mean, what it is really is adrenaline. But you're in something which is unpredictable and powerful and is not going to just suddenly stop and sit down and cross their legs and, you know, start a little campfire and start singing songs. It's the, you know, fight or flight adrenaline charge, but it does arise out of this, and that's the buzz. That's the buzz. It's the buzz of complete present tenseness, where you are threatening and threatened, menacing and menaced, and anything can happen, and it is almost certain that something will happen.
A lot of the themes in this book have, in the last 10 years, sluiced into the political mainstream and effectively changed the world. I mean, you've got the kind of weird, angsty masculinity is in there. You've got, well, in as it pertains to Britain, you've got kind of latent racism, because I know that you visited a National Front disco because of the fact that the National Front used football matches as recruiting grounds. You've got that. You've got a kind of a bored and alienated class of people whose lives are effectively dull and they don't see a whole lot of meaning in it. And in when English fans go abroad, you see that weird kind of proto imperialism of standing in a foreign square, singing about the RAF and defending the Queen. And all of these...
It's Brexit. It's sort of Brexit and anticipating Brexit.
That's exactly where I'm going. Were you surprised? Did you see that vote coming then? Because you had mapped all these psychologies fucking nearly 25 years earlier in this book.
I understood the result. I was very sad about it because I really like Britain being part of Europe, and I enjoyed that it was part of Europe, and it enhanced the prospect that I'd be returning there as a potentially a citizen. And I was very depressed that happened, but I knew exactly why it happened. I knew the attitudes, I knew the peoples, I knew the towns, I knew the community. And I blame the European Union too, because they're so high-minded and so patronizing. And this was not a people to that would tolerate being patronized to. It was, I understood it completely. Little Englanders. Hmm. And it's a very big part of the population, just like it's a very big part of the population here. It's in a way, it's almost more surprising that it's happening here because those are the Trump supporters. But it was, I knew those people.
Yeah. And
they're my friends.
Okay. Have you kept in touch with many of our hooligan friends?
I did for a while. Several of them died, including Mick, which isn't so entirely surprising. He died, he was the guy I met on a train on my way up to Manchester for my first match.
This is eight liters of wine in one go, Mick.
This is the man who could put away, and in his company, I put away more beer than I'd ever had in my life. I mean, just pints and pints and pints and pints. That was just after the match. And he carried on in that fashion, and, with fish and chips in one hand and a 5-liter bottle of something else in the other. And he had a heart attack, which is not surprising. And a few others. But I've actually only kept really in touch with one who's become a friend. And the last time I was in England, we had a meal. He was convinced I was a member of the CIA. And at our meal, we had this freaky coincidence. We had a freaky coincidence where, like, well-dressed people would suddenly appear nearby to us, looking completely inappropriately out of place. And so we'd move to another location, and then someone else would appear, and then we went to another location, and then, like, very elegant black man arrived reading this gigantic encyclopedia of medicine, and he thought, "Nah, what's going on here?" And then we went to another. He's convinced I was CIA because he thought he told a story that he thought illustrated my CIA training, which was flattering because I'm not a member of the CIA. But there was a time when it was very important for the local police to show that they were getting on top of the crowd violence. By doing early morning raids and arresting hooligans. Most of those arrests didn't actually lead to sentencing, but they were very spectacular, and they would be in the news, and they did it in London, and they did it in Leeds, but where they hadn't done it was Manchester, and so the Manchester police mounted a raid finally and arrested a bunch of people, but this time my book was published, and the word the police put about the word that I was their source, that I had given them names, and I had basically ratted them all out. It was a kind of theatrical piece of fake arrests, and I don't think anybody got charged because they were doing it just for the attention. But this was very sullying to me because I actually did have meetings with Scotland Yard, and they did ask me for information, and I said I couldn't do that, and they got very nasty with me that would be the case, and I want help from them, but I'm not giving them any help. I mean, the only help I wanted was, I was just interested in their tactics.
Yeah.
And so I went up to Manchester, and I think it was a big evening match. I heard it. I was in London. I got on the train and straight up to Manchester, missed the match, but didn't need to go to the match because my plan was that I knew what exit they'd all be coming out via. And so I just stood there so that everybody could see me, and stood there for about half an hour. Finally saw one of my friends, Robert, and Robert said, come on to the pub. And it was the pub where everybody went, and included a lot of people that I hadn't met. But he said that it was very much more tense than I realized. He said there were people there who were debating who was going to come and stab me. And I just, I was uncomfortable, but I was there, and I was there to show that it wasn't me. I wouldn't be here if it was me. You should know that this is impossible, and here I am. And he said, after he said, like, how did you know how to do that? Where'd you get your training? You are CIA. I'm sure you're CIA. It's CIA. They teach you how to do that, don't they? I'm not CIA.
That, in fairness, is exactly what someone in the CIA would say, Bill. But we'll take
it. It's true. I think if I knew there were people there debating when to stab me, I would have been much less comfortable than I was. I wasn't comfortable, but I think I would have been really, really uncomfortable. I was like, whoop, gotta get my tree. Bye-bye.
How is the book received in England when it first came out? I haven't checked this, but I can imagine it didn't go down too well, because I think it may have shone a few lights in places of society where England wasn't fully ready to reckon with yet.
I think that's fair. There are a couple things on television. I think there's some Newsnight stuff. And there were reviews. The best review I remember is a review of a journalist who was on the bus with me in Turin.
Ah.
Which I wasn't to know. But, you know, there's a moment where you think, like, it wasn't written about in the papers. I know the journalists. I know the sports journalists, and they weren't about to write it. And they were all, you know, I've been with them before. They do their copy, and then they get on the plane and then go home. Or they go back to the hotel and get pissed. but the, at some point I thought, God, did I make this up? Because it's so... I mean, I had all my notes, and my memories are all very vivid, but it's like, there's no other, there was the Italian press was big and vigorous and loud. But apart from that, there was no one in England. And here was the guy who said, I was on that bus, and that's one of the most frightening experiences of my life. And that time with the Manchester fans was just terrifying. I think it was in the Independent. And I thought, yes, you're right. It was pretty mixed. There are a lot of things people didn't want to know. A lot of sports journals thought I'd meet up with them on some of the matches abroad or at the World Cup, and they thought I was evil for doing this. I'm doing a part of the sport which is ruining the game. The game was in trouble, and those are fair points. Except that I really didn't think it was normal that people every week would go out and just beat the hell out of each other. Mm. This is not normal behavior, and that is why I was there. And I wasn't trying to glamorize them or defend them, but it had a kind of mixed reception.
Do you still follow football, and what do you make of how it's changed, particularly at Premier League level, over the last nearly 30 years now?
I do follow football. I have a problem with the time difference. I try to write in the morning, so the only time I can get to watch the matches is usually in the morning when I should be writing. But it's good and bad. I mean, it's good insofar as I remember going to a, I don't know where I went, some miserable match, west of London somewhere. Maybe it was raining. It's awful. The toilets didn't work, and everybody was kind of disgusting, and the football was miserable, and the pitch was just in very bad repair. And I thought, what the game needs is television, and it needs to be treated as a game and pleasure and entertaining, because it is a really, really highly entertaining and beautiful sport. And they need to do away with the terraces, and they need to pamper people and come up with expensive seats and treat it basically like American football. And now I regret having that thought because that's what's happened. Well, it's good that it happened because actually it should be a family sport, and it is a family sport. But Rupert Murdoch stepped in and said, this is entertainment. Sports is big crowds, big money. And once there's big money in the game, then the game changes and the how fans are accommodated change, and there's money for players, and the game now stopped being English and became kind of a European commodity. So now you've got the Champions League, which is almost like they're almost like big luxury products like Prada or something like that. They're these magical entities, in Spain and Italy and Germany. They can afford anybody from anywhere, and they're producing this show that has nothing to do with where they're from. And I miss that, and I'm sorry that happened, but it's a great game. It's a great game. It's a beautiful, beautiful game. And it has changed radically, radically, radically. But it didn't have a future before, with the toilets not working and the filthy food and the fans couldn't get out because they were visiting fans, and everybody had to pee, so they pee in their shoes, and it's there wasn't a future there. Something's lost, but I was glad I got to see it. Although the terrorists finally did kill a lot of people, and that was horrible, and the terrorists had to go, and the way the terrorists were exploited by the police by packing people into them so they'd get them off the streets. I was glad I got to participate in the terrorists. It goes back to, it's like a very fundamental crowd moment. And in a way, the football violence kind of arises out of the terraces, because you've got this kind of this intimacy of being part of a crowd.
In your time editing Granta and your time as fiction editor at The New Yorker, did any sports writing cross your desk often? There has been, it's changed, I think, in the last 10, 15 years, but there has often been a full delineation between literary writing and sport.
Yes. I think it's pretty, and to be fair to the good writing about sports, it's much better than the good writing about food, which is the other thing that I do. People are more, so-called literary writers tend to be, or used to be, more embarrassed to be writing about food rather than literature. So they would have to show that they were really literary. There's been a rather beautiful tradition, both here and in Britain, of writing well about sports. And I think that's magnificent. The New Yorker has a history of writers who write well about sports. From A.J. Liebling to Roger Angel. Roger Angel is the great New Yorker writer who is now 100, who is a history of writing about baseball. And I met him when I first went to the New Yorker. He's very, very sweet, and he was very accommodating. This was quite a while ago, but he said, there's a book in Britain that is really, really good. It's about the fans and the violence. And I said, Roger, you're so sweet. I wrote that. He said, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I think I have a fantasy, which will not come to pass, about writing a poetics about sport. And what I'm thinking about is the Greek philosopher Aristotle wrote a thing called the Poetics, which was a way of trying to describe, like an anatomy lesson, this new thing that everybody was excited about called the theater. And he wrote about what characterizes a tragedy and what it needs and this and the other things. But it was like a stepping back and saying, wow, what is this thing in ancient Greece that we call theater? And I think, the most magnificent, unpredictable, deeply satisfying live theater that we have is sport. And all over the world,
There's millions and millions of people every weekend who stop what they're doing, leave their lives, and get engaged by sport and become really, really passionate about it. I mean, we're speaking on the days before the Super Bowl. You know, in the entire country, even without crowds, they're all gonna be watching the Super Bowl. But it's like, I just think like what happens in Italy on Saturdays or in Latin America, you know, for anywhere with us. This is, it's a huge thing, and it's got rules and patterns, but more than anything else, it's unpredictable theater. One of the great elements of any drama is suspense and surprise. And in a narrative, you set up expectations, and if you've got your reader with you or your member of your audience with you, you're setting up an expectation that something's going to happen, and then this happens. And you want to do it in such a way so it's not completely unforeseen, and then that's a surprise, and then that happens, and then that happens. Well, man, football match. What's the, you know, that famous one with Man United and Bayern Munich, and Man United was behind 3-1, and they had to go into, you know, time added on, and it was like 9 minutes, and then everything happened, and then Man United won, and I was watching it in a pub here in New York, and I remember thinking, the whole pub, it was packed with people. We all just thought, they're not going to win it. They're not going to get the championship. They're going to lose it again to Bayern Munich, of all people. And then they came and they won it. It was spectacular.
And it was... And it's one thing that football has in your American sports, I'm afraid, because, you know, football games can go, an hour and a half is a long time, and it can be insanely boring. It can finish 0-0. There might not even be a score, and there might not be a winner. But it's important to know that a football, like, literally nothing can happen, because that makes the suspense all the better. You know,
that
there doesn't have to be a final act.
No story at all. Yeah, it's no story at all. That was what I enjoyed so much about waiting for a goal, because the heart of it is that it's 0-0 on a rainy day, and you got to trek all the way home again afterwards. And it's like, you know, well, but you don't think that's a waste of time. You think that's the sport.
Yeah.
As a fantastic feature of it. Fantastic feature of it.
Can I briefly ask what was probably a very basic question about being fiction editor at The New Yorker? But I mean, you have very, very big literary names and writers like submitting work to you. How is it editing these big names, or do you get out of their way?
Oh, it's actually, with the exception of a couple people who were very testy when I got there, and I think they were testy when I got there because they'd had bad experiences. It was much easier editing there than it was editing Granta. Granta, I got a lot of the same level of writers, partly because I think The New Yorker was in decline and they were being rejected by The New Yorker. But they would submit something. In the beginning, especially, there was a belief that they were doing me a favor. And so then when I would edit them, they'd get it. It could be very difficult. When I got to The Yorker, everybody expects to be edited. So it was easy. I mean, everybody expects to be edited. I mean, the testy ones were like Philip Roth, who had obviously been rejected. And I did something from a new novel. Tina Brown was in the editor, and she was even kind of thought, what are you doing? It has him masturbating on a woman's grave, and is this really what, you know, you've been hired to do? And he was testy. I mean, we couldn't change anything. And another one was Annie Prue, who clearly had bad experiences with The New Yorker, so she submitted her story to a couple magazines, and we all wanted it. And I had to make my pitch, and I love the story. It was long stories, like 9,000 words. And we then worked on it together, and I had enormous fun editing it. She was really responsive to my editing, which was just, you know, editing is just, you're just, especially if it's a good story, you're reading and you're just, anytime you stop or something doesn't seem right or word choice is wrong, you're just offering up your responses as a reader. Because if you've got a lovely piece of writing, you just offer your, that's what my position is. I'm like an informed person who loves a thing, and if I get stopped by something, then I share it. And so we had a blast. We had a couple days of editing, and the story was a Brokeback Mountain, and that then became a movie, and then it became a book, and it was a great moment for me, because it was occupied a big part of the magazine, and I could was able to say, "Hey, people, this is big. Get you know, clear out the pages. This is big." It was very exciting, and I haven't heard from Annie for a while, but she I do regard her now as a good friend, and I was like, just you know, I had the showcase. I was in the right spot. There's some dust clearing that needed to be done, and it was these are great moments.
Among the Thugs, was that ever optioned for the screen? Is it ever going to happen?
Yes, repeatedly. The most promising, I think, was Kiefer Sutherland wanted to do it, but kept renewing an option, which was really nice because then I could make some money every year. And he didn't like the scripts he got. I saw him actually at a hotel, the W, near where we lived by Union Square. And I said, "Keep it, anyway." There was a play which was really good that was done in Chicago. And there was some people in New York who wanted to bring it to New York, but they wanted the movie rights. But at that point, I'd given them movie rights to, is it Malcolm McLaren, the punk rock guy?
Oh, I think it's Malcolm McLaren, yeah.
And Malcolm, I thought Malcolm would be able to pull something off. He didn't offer me much money. He offered me no money. And I let this thing go, which probably would have resulted in a film, because they were going to do it in, they're going to do it off Broadway.
Yeah, Malcolm McLaren, who managed the Sex Pistols. I assume that Malcolm
yeah,
McLaren.
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah,
and then
one.
But like
Mr. Huckster.
We've also live in a world with three Green Street movies. Have you seen them?
There's three.
I think there's three. There's definitely two. There's the second one is set in a prison. It's god awful. And I think there's a third one. Now the latter two were, you know, straight to DVD, like cost about the price of a bag of cans, you know, it'd been very low budget stuff. But Green Street One was fairly, you know, fairly high profile. I think Elijah Wood did it not long after Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, I saw the script. Someone gave me the script and I thought that was borrowing pretty heavily. But there you go.
Yeah. Your most recent book is Dirt, which is your account of moving to Lyon and becoming a chef there. I might start by asking you about that. What's the more violent masculine environment, a Saturday with the Millwall firm or a French kitchen?
Oh, they're comparable. They're comparable. The previous book I wrote was about being in an Italian kitchen in New York. And that was mainly men. There were women. They survived somehow. They were great women. And I thought, wow, it's like being with the Thugs again. you're in this confined space. You know, what it is like you're in this, when you're with the crowd and with the Thugs, there's a basic code, which is an anti-code. So you're not going to obey any rules. You're not governed by any rules. All the normal social expectations of how you're going to behave are ignored, and you have your own dynamic. And here I was in a kitchen where you're closed off from the front of the restaurant. There's something about, like I was then at the New Yorker, and I'd leave the New Yorker, I'd take the subway down, I'd go to Washington Square, it'd be a lovely day, it's a lovely neighborhood, I'd pass through the dining room, they were getting ready for the dinner service, and then you go into the kitchen and the door closes and you're in this other world, and then it's nothing ever is the same. The French kitchen was like that as well. And that was born out of, I learned to cook and to work in a restaurant, and I learned Italian food and I learned Italian and went to Italy, but I always wanted to learn French food and learn French, and I threw myself in it again, but this time I had twin toddlers and a wife. I can't possibly meet something. I'm just going to be repetition of what I had before in my kitchens in New York, but it was extreme. It was extreme. And it was closed off. And it's been suggested that I've done something very bad, like violating the code of the mafia by telling people what it's really like. But it was rough. Yeah, people got hit and pans got thrown at people's heads and women got terrorized. And for my purposes, it was extreme. But for my purposes, It's good copy.
Yeah. You know,
it's, yeah, I got my story.
Bill, we're steering for home. We're nearly done. We have a couple of stock questions that we throw at everyone on the show. So here they go. Where is the most interesting place that work has taken you?
Among the thugs or anything?
Anywhere. Pick anything.
A lot of places. And that's been a huge... That's probably why I like to write, is I like to go... What I really like to do is go someplace and then fall in love with it and then want to be a member of the place I found. And like when I was in France, I loved being in Lyon. We stayed in Lyon 5 years. There's no reason for me to stay in Lyon 5 years. I spent a year, nearly a year in Italy for the other book. I spent 6 years at Among the Thugs, but I kind of want to get to know it and I get engaged by it. I love Lyon. I love bringing up my boys there. They're fluent French speakers. I loved Italy. But I like Germany. My favorite place is went into the jungles in Brazil in pursuit of kind of like the secret of chocolate. And that was... I wrote about it for The New Yorker, and the piece is fine. I had much more information than I could get into the piece, and I just went into the world so exotic and weird and untouched for 100 years. And in Bahia, it's kind of the wild part of Brazil. Absolutely fabulous, fabulous.
And lastly, Bill, who is the most interesting person that you've met with work?
Oh.
That question has never not been met by a loud exhalation and oh.
I don't know. I love my subjects. I write about them in ways that they don't always like. I wrote a profile of Lucinda Williams, the Louisiana singer, that was shortlisted for a prize and got a nice, really nice response. And I really like her. I like, because I'm born in Louisiana and I kind of like what she's doing in her myth-making in Louisiana. And I spent a long time with her. She hated it. She cried. Oh. But there's other people where I make fun of them and they can tell that I'm, you know, I you spend a long time with people and you get all their complexities, but I like them. I like the oyster guy. You know, I like the Italian butcher. I love the Italian butcher. He's become a friend. I like my pickpocket friend from Among the Thugs, who's the guy that I still see, who fills me with great stories. Recently, I was reminded of I did a story. I was starting to write about food for The New Yorker. I did a story at a guy who I really, again, I kind of love him, though. He gave me lots of copy, named Joe Hutto. And my story then became a documentary for public television here. And I kind of changed his life. But Joe is like he's one of these weird, natural world people who befriends snakes and alligators and rattlers and loves living out in nature. And he's like a boy's own story of dangerous creatures. And at one point, someone had given him some turkey eggs, wild turkey eggs, and he raised the wild turkeys to a point where he learned to walk like a wild turkey and talk like a wild turkey, and the wild turkeys all regarded him as their parent. And it resulted finally in a moment, you know, because in turkeys you got jakes, which are males, and the hens. But the jakes get quite aggressive because they're at a time where they have to like go off and, you know, inseminate their hens, and there's a competition. And so the jakes they then turned on him because they regarded him as like the big, you know, the big male turkey. And there was a moment when he had, you know, they kind of attacked his head and tried to, you know, tear him apart. And but I had a nice moment too with him. Where I said, you know, show me how you walk like a turkey. And he did a turkey walk with turkey clucking. And as it happens, I'm kind of obsessed with wild turkeys and I like to hunt wild turkeys. And I have had experiences where to get a turkey, I had to pretend to be a turkey butt using a device to make a noise. So I understood what he was doing, but it was beautiful, his wild turkey.
That's the absolutely perfect note to leave this conversation on. Bill Beaufort, thank you so much for doing the podcast. Hope you enjoyed it.
Thank you so much. It was a great, great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much to Bill for joining us on this week's show. You can get in touch with us, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, or you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. Thanks again for your support of Behind the Lines and the 42 at large. It really is greatly appreciated. We wouldn't be here without you. And if you are somewhat new to the show, there's an absolutely mega back catalogue at this point, which you can work your way through. And if you want to get it, and do get in touch with us, even if you want the collated list of all of our guests' reading recommendations from the series so far, it's an absolutely whopper reading list to get you through lockdown 3 and whatever grim prospective lockdown 4 is ahead of us all. But let's not worry about that, because we will be back next week here on Behind the Lines with another great guest. But until then, take it easy.